Testosterone use in older men.
Can a diabetic medicine prevent a second stroke?
Carotid stenting or endarterectomy. Love that terminology in people who don't have symptoms of carotid artery blockage.
And managing Ebola virus disease in the United States and Europe.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on February 19th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, we are picking everything from the New England Journal of Medicine this week, so that's the first and last time I'm going to say that. And I think we should start first with this recurrent, ongoing issue of what about testosterone supplementation as men age?
We know that there are important age-related problems in men. We also know that testosterone levels decrease in men as well. And the question is whether we can prevent some of those age-related problems by actually giving testosterone supplements. We've talked before about the danger of giving testosterone in individuals that may not have particularly low levels. But in this study, they targeted men that were 65 years or older, and they had a low serum testosterone level, less than 275, and symptoms, and they placed them on either testosterone gel or placebo for a year. There were almost 800 men enrolled in this trial, and it addressed issues related to psychosexual function, physical function, and vitality. And here's what they discovered. After a year of study, those men that received the testosterone gel had an increase in their testosterone levels to kind of the middle range in middle-aged men. And with that, there was a significantly increased sexual activity, an increase in sexual desire and erectile function, a very modest increase in their physical function as assessed by a 6-minute walk test, and really no significant change in the overall vitality. It appears that there are moderate beneficial effects in some of these, but there didn't appear to be any increased adverse events in this trial in the men who received testosterone.
A couple salient points here, I think. One of them is that these men did have established low levels of testosterone, and that, of course, is a question that is ongoing. Who's taking the stuff, and do they really have low levels? The other thing is that, as you've already alluded, I think the cardiovascular disease risk question is one that's not going to be answered in the short term. It's going to require years of follow-up.
Both those points are excellent. And in particular, they screened over 51,000 men to find the 790 that actually met the criteria. So that means only 1.5% of the men screened actually were enrolled in the trial. And as you said, we need to follow this out for longer periods to look at cardiovascular disease. And then there are four other studies that are going to be reported in the future related to the effects of testosterone.
Well, we'll be watching as we've been watching so far. Let's turn now to Ebola virus treatment in the U.S. and Europe.
When we take a step back now, Ebola virus disease, the news hit about a year ago. And in West Africa, there were over 28,000 reported cases and more than 11,000 deaths. So what that means is that in West Africa, the mortality ranged from about 37% to 74%, depending upon where it was evaluated. With increased knowledge and transport of some of these individuals to places that had better care facilities, particularly the United States and Europe, the question is, does that significantly impact upon mortality? And during this time period, there were 27 patients who received their care either in Europe or in the United States. The mortality in these individuals was only 18.5%, so markedly reduced. And how did they do that? They had severe electrolyte abnormalities, and those were corrected. They had severe diarrhea and vomiting. That is, they had hypovolemia. They received intravenous treatment. Some of these individuals had hypoxemia, decreased oxygen content in their blood, and they were treated either with oxygen, sometimes with mechanical ventilation. Some actually needed dialysis. And then a substantial portion were placed on experimental medications. What we can say is that very aggressive care did reduce the mortality to about 1 in 5 in these individuals.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting in this study is that many of these treatments that were implemented, the electrolytes, the fluids, they don't require super intensive kinds of situations in order to use those.
No, but what it does require is access to a lab. So you're right in that if we face this again in countries that have limited medical resources, they may not have any of the investigational medications, but what we do need to make sure is they have access to intravenous fluids and access to laboratory data so that we can correct the electrolyte abnormalities that occur.
Well, No doubt we're going to face another pandemic at some point. So these are good lessons. Let's turn to this other issue. I served up the long phraseology, carotid stenting in folks or endarterectomy in folks who are asymptomatic with regard to carotid stenosis. Yikes. There's an awful lot going on there.
Since stroke affects nearly 800,000 people in the United States each year and results in more than 170,000 deaths, and as we all agree, it causes major morbidity, there's increased interest in preventing stroke either the first time or if it occurs, those individuals have an increased risk of developing a stroke or a precursor called a transient ischemic attack a second time. So how can we prevent that? We use multiple medications like antiplatelet agents and statins and cholesterol-lowering medications. But it's been the practice in the United States based upon old studies that if someone has a significant blockage in their carotid artery, 60% or more, that they have some sort of a procedure to relieve that blockage, whether the patient is symptomatic or asymptomatic. And in the past, that has been doing a surgery called a carotid endarterectomy. Now we have access to stents as well, which is obviously a less invasive procedure in that it's non-surgical. But the question is it as effective? There are two studies in the New England Journal of Medicine that address that, one in asymptomatic individuals and the other in individuals that are symptomatic or asymptomatic. The study in asymptomatic individuals suggests that the two procedures are fairly equivalent. The risk of stroke in the territory supplied to that artery is about 5 to 6%, maybe 7% over a 5-year period, regardless of which procedure is used. There's a slightly increased risk of stroke following the stenting compared to the endarterectomy, but a higher incidence of heart attack after the surgery. In the other study, they've had results for 10 years, and again, the procedures look about equivalent. Now, here's what neither study addresses, is over the last 5 or 10 years, our medical therapy has gotten better. And it now looks like if you have a significant blockage and you don't have symptoms, your risk of stroke is less than 1% per year with current medical therapy.
Gosh, I wouldn't want either one if I didn't have to have them. And is this, in your opinion, going to reverse the recommendation that's given to many primary care docs with regard to listening to somebody's carotid artery using a stethoscope, really non-invasive, very simple kind of thing to assess initially whether they might have a blockage?
Well, if we identify a stenosis by listening over the artery and then following up with the study, and we identify such a patient, it puts them at high risk, but it doesn't necessarily mean they need to have a procedure. It may cause us to intensify our medical therapy, and that may be the way we need to go.
I guess I would ask you for right now, while we're awaiting the results of this comparison trial, what would you do for someone who has a 60% plus blockage?
I would remind our listeners is that these studies were done at centers in which the investigators were very accomplished. They had a tremendous amount of experience with either the surgery, if it was done by a surgeon, or with the stenting. And I'm not sure that these results can be replicated in the community. I do think the studies are pretty clear that medical therapy is very good. So if it was me, for example, and I had an 80% blockage, I wouldn't jump to a procedure, but I would intensify medical therapy.
Well, you segued us, of course, very nicely into our final study, both medical therapy and stroke. This is using the diabetes medication pioglitazone after stroke.
We know that intensifying medical therapy to some extent in people that have diabetes can reduce some of the vascular complications. But about 50% of individuals that have a stroke and don't have diabetes have what's called insulin resistance. They don't have frank diabetes, but they do require higher insulin levels to bring their glucose levels down. And these people, by the way, often have other metabolic abnormalities like high triglycerides or high blood pressure. So you might hypothesize that in individuals that have already had a stroke and are at increased risk for another one and have insulin resistance, can you lower their risk of having a second stroke by putting them on a diabetic medication, a particular one called pioglitazone? And that's what this study did. Of almost 4,000 patients that had had a stroke or a transient ischemic attack, and they received either pioglitazone or placebo. And they followed them for 5 years. And those that received pioglitazone reduced their risk of having another stroke or TIA by about 24%. It reduced their risk of developing diabetes by about 50%. But unfortunately, there were some side effects, greater frequency of weight gain, edema or swelling in the legs, and a higher incidence of bone fracture requiring surgery or hospitalization.
Wow. Here's one of those risk-benefit analyses for us, isn't it?
You are absolutely right. These were carefully selected patients. We know that pioglitazone can be associated with heart failure. So these individuals did not have a history of heart failure at all. But you're right, it's a risk-benefit analysis.
And also, gosh, we've reported so many times of dangers with regard to these glitazone medications. So I guess that's another thing that's rattling around in the back of my mind.
And because of that, what I'd say is, I don't think we can say this applies to all of the medications in this class. I think this is one of those studies where you say, if you're going to use one of these medications, it ought to be this particular one and not its related sisters or brothers.
Excellent. On that note, I'm going to talk about the testosterone supplementation in older men on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.